fines are coming down this week on two companies that separately violated user privacy and compromised people's data in a massive security breach. On Monday, the Federal Trade Commission announced that credit reporting agency Equifax agreed to pay up to $700 million to help compensate the victims of hackers who stole data from Equifax customers. Then yesterday, the FTC handed down a finalized $5 billion fine to Facebook for privacy violations. And it granted federal regulators access to Facebook's business decisions for the next two decades. What are your questions about consumer protection and how personal data may be at risk? What do you want to know? What will change around privacy in the wake of these settlements? We're at 800-642-1234. Stacey Cowley is a finance reporter for the New York Times. She focuses on consumer issues and data security. Stacey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So before we get to Facebook, let's start with Equifax. The credit reporting agency agreed to this up to $700 million. How significant is this settlement?
It's an interesting mix. It is a record amount of money for a settlement like this. So it's certainly the largest settlement we've seen of this type for a data breach. However, it does not involve any significant new restrictions on what data Equifax can collect or what it can do with it, which is something that I think consumers were widely talking about in the wake of this kind of breach.
Oh, so it doesn't necessarily have to change any of its ways that got itself into this position before?
It is required to do some additional spending on cybersecurity to beef up its defenses, which was something it had already agreed to in previous settlement with some state regulators. So it is going to have to spend more money, make stronger efforts to protect its data, but this didn't really put any new restrictions on its ability to collect that data in the first place, or any new restrictions on what it's allowed to do with it as part of its business.
Remind us what happened in 2017. How many people were affected by the data breach and what went down?
So Equifax has credit files on hundreds of millions of people worldwide, and in this case, it was a huge number of people that were affected. 147 million people were affected by Equifax's loss of a portion of that data. The sort of good news was that the data they lost was sensitive, but not the most sensitive it had. The information that was stolen on most of the 147 million people who were affected was things like social security number, name, address, details like that. It wasn't the core information in people's credit files. The hackers did not get information on your personal finances, your personal financial accounts, things like that. But 147 million people's social security numbers and names are now out there in someone else's hands.
Yeah, and social security numbers are, those can unlock doors, certainly. They're very sensitive.
Yes, so, this was certainly information that should not have gotten out there publicly.
And how did the breach affect victims? How have we seen people impacted?
Well, that's one of the interesting parts of this, is that that data is not known to have publicly surfaced anywhere. Equifax has said they haven't seen it available for sale or posted publicly anywhere. Law enforcement officials have said the same. So although we still don't actually know who the attackers were, they have never been publicly identified, that information has not come out, which doesn't mean it can't in the future. The presumption among cybersecurity experts was that this was probably some sort of nation-state attack. So that data may never be publicly available, but it's certainly out there in the hands of people who are not supposed to have it.
I recall in 2017, you were able to find out if you were one of the people whose data had been compromised. Can you still find out if you were part of this breach?
Yes. So if anyone's wanting to find out if they are part of the breach, the first place to go is the website EquifaxBreachSettlement.com. That's an official website that's set up by the group that's going to administer the breach settlement. And there's a tool on there where you type in your last name, you type in a portion of your social security number, and it will tell you if you are one of the 147 million people who were affected.
We're talking with Stacey Cowley. She is a finance reporter at the New York Times. Was your data or your friends or family's data leaked in the Equifax breach? How did you find out? How did it affect your life? Join in the conversation with your questions, your reaction to the settlement, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Stacey, how can people who've been affected by the breach file a claim for compensation? And what does compensation look like here?
So the way to file a claim is right through that same website, EquifaxBreachSettlement.com, and it is currently accepting claims. So you can go on there right now and start filling it out and put your claim into the queue. The settlement that the lawyers involved in this negotiated for consumers involves two kind of core things. For every single person whose data was exposed, you're eligible for 10 years of free credit monitoring or some other compensation along those lines. If you've already paid for your own credit monitoring service, you can put in for a refund for the money you've paid, and you'll be able to take advantage of that service to kind of keep an ongoing watch on your data. The other thing, which was novel and the sort of first time we've seen this kind of thing in this kind of settlement, is the consumer lawyers who represented consumers in this settlement made a real point of saying, look, even if people's data is not publicly out there, even if we don't know if any fraud was committed because of this, people spent a lot of time and effort and energy dealing with this, and they can put in for compensation for that. So if you, for instance, bought credit monitoring services, spent time on the phone with banks or financial services providers trying to deal with this, you can put in for compensation at up to $25 an hour for that time that you spent.
Oh, okay. And so that can then equate to a monetary, a dollar amount as to what your compensation you would ask, you know, what it could look like.
Yes. And the lawyers felt that was important. They said, look, people spent their time dealing with this. They should be compensated for that time.
We have a caller here who couldn't stay with us from Toma and was asking if the breach could be responsible for all the telemarketing calls that this person gets. But as you said, this hasn't surfaced elsewhere, this data. So could it be linked at all to telemarketing?
Not that we know of, but one of the challenges with this is that because we still don't know publicly who took it, what they've done with it, there are questions. I mean, officially, law enforcement and Equifax say there's been no signs of any actual impact on consumers linked to this. But again, that's something we may not know the real answer to for years.
So how did hackers get access to this information in the first place? Where were the fault lines inside Equifax?
This all started with one little mistake inside Equifax. There was a known vulnerability in one of their software systems. There had been public advisories telling companies using this software to issue a fix, patch a problem with it. Equifax missed those and didn't, and the attackers got in through this known vulnerability, and from there, very carefully executed this fairly sophisticated attack to use that access, leverage it to access to other databases, quietly sit in the network, and quietly extract data for about 3 months before they were caught.
Wow, 3 months it went on without any interruption.
Yeah, that was part of the scandal in response to this was both that Equifax hadn't patched that software in the first place, but also that its intrusion detection systems weren't working properly. So it didn't know for several months that it had been violated.
We are looking at Federal Trade Commission settlements over data privacy, over security enforcement under the law. We're talking about Equifax right now. Stacey Cowley covers finance for the New York Times and focuses on consumer issues and data security. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Was your data leaked in the Equifax breach? Did you look yourself up? How did you realize what had happened? And how has it affected your life? Have you equated the time you've spent on it with a dollar amount? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about settlements coming out of the Federal Trade Commission surrounding the enforcement of data security and privacy. This week, the Federal Trade Commission finalized the two largest fines for data security and privacy violations the agency has ever approved. There was Equifax, accused of failing to adequately patch a security flaw, enabling hackers to gather private information on about 147 million people, and Equifax will pay up to $700 million for that data breach. And then there's Facebook. We heard yesterday a record $5 billion settlement was finalized over the company's privacy policies. Have you ever heard of Equifax before the data breach? Did you realize that you may have had your personal information accessed? What did you do? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Stacey Cowley is a finance reporter for the New York Times, and she stays with us. Stacey, states will get money out of the Equifax settlement. Wisconsin is getting just north of $2 million. What will states do with this money, and how are they settling here with Equifax?
Many of them are going to use it to continue their consumer protection efforts. When states get money in fines like this, it typically goes back into their investigative funds to cover their costs of this investigation and future ones along these lines.
What has Equifax said about all of this? Has the company said it will change its security policies?
It has certainly been completely roiled by this. The scandal forced out its CEO, forced out several other top officials. They have publicly committed to being the best corporate actor in America when it comes to security policies. They have done a lot of new hiring in that area, put a lot more investment into it, and at least publicly, very publicly committed to reforming and making sure that nothing like this can ever possibly happen again.
But how do we know? I mean, how do we know that's not just a front, or whether that will really work? I mean, do companies really have to step up their game here?
Well, there has been increased attention from regulators, particularly some state regulators, interestingly, to that issue. New York State came out with a bunch of additional cybersecurity rules that large corporations, anyone who does business in the state, is now required to comply with. I think we do see regulators and overseers paying more proactive attention to this in annual checks and things like that, really taking a look to make sure the companies have good cybersecurity policies, that they're actually enforcing them, that they're actually taking the steps they need to proactively to prevent things like this. But as we've also seen, large data breaches continue to happen almost constantly. So I think it's fair to say Equifax is genuinely committed to reforming and making sure that this kind of thing does not happen again to it. That doesn't mean we're not going to see similar things happen at other companies.
Let's bring in a call now. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Good morning, Tom.
I just typed in my website that she gave me, and they asked me to put in my six numbers, the last six numbers of my Social Security, and then it comes out, thank you, your account has been impacted by this thing. Unbelievable. And so then I guess now I can file a claim online. If you want to submit a hard copy, then it goes into this whole thing. The blood just dropped to my feet. I can't tell you what it's like.
So, Tom, you didn't realize until now, until you entered in your information, that you were part of this breach. Yeah.
You guys just gave me the number of the website a while ago, and so I typed it in, and that's what I got. It told me that my account has been impacted. Unbelievable.
Tom, thanks for the call. Stacey, it sounds like, too, that even though this breach happened in 2017, that people will still hear during the settlement start to find out that they were part of this.
Yeah, I think it was a sufficiently, most people had never heard of Equifax before this. The credit bureaus are not something that people necessarily pay attention to on a daily basis. So I think a lot of people are still finding out for the first time that they were caught up in this.
Does this send a signal that the Federal Trade Commission is becoming a bit, cracking down a bit more on privacy?
I think there's certainly, yes, they're paying more attention to it. They also have some constraints on what they can do. It was interesting. The fines that Equifax paid to the federal government for this went to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Equifax didn't pay any fine to the FTC, in part because the FTC has no legal ability to impose fines for most first-time violations. The record $5 billion fine we saw on Facebook, that was because they had previously sanctioned Facebook for its privacy policies, and that did give them the ability to go after them for a second violation. But that is a challenge the FTC faces. It has primary federal responsibility for overseeing data security, and yet it has limited powers to punish companies when they overstep.
Well, let's look at Facebook here for a moment. $5 billion seems like a lot of money that Facebook is having to settle here over privacy violations. What went on?
Well, that's a record amount. It's certainly a huge amount of money for you or me. It's also something that's not a huge amount of money for Facebook. Its quarterly profits are still pretty, you know, unfazed by this. They dropped slightly, but the company is still making lots and lots of money. What went on here in this case, though, was that Facebook got sanctioned not for collecting the data and not for necessarily what it did with the data, but for not being clear to users about what it was going to do with the data. So the core of what Facebook got punished here for was transparency, was for not being upfront with users about what it was collecting and what it was doing with that. Interestingly, the punishment did not actually restrict Facebook's ability to collect this kinds of data. It simply said you have to be very transparent with users when you do that.
So it was collecting data unbeknownst to the user and then turning around and selling it or using it in some way?
In this case, the core of what happened with Cambridge Analytica, which was the core of what got Facebook on people's radar about this, was that it was allowing a third party to collect user data and remove user data from the platform and not being very clear to users that that was happening.
And the federal government, I understand, will be able to have a direct hand in seeing how Facebook goes forward with transparency. What does that look like in terms of Facebook's reporting to federal regulators?
There will be increased monitoring. They will certainly be paying closer attention to how Facebook lives up to the promises it made in this latest agreement. So there will be ongoing attention to this issue on behalf of the FTC, and certainly lawmakers are now paying more attention to this.
You have written that the Equifax breach in particular showed just how little control we have over our personal data. What do you mean by that?
One of the great frustrations for people with Equifax is that there is no way to remove yourself from its databases. You are not Equifax's customer, you are its product. So you can exercise some limited control about what Equifax does with your data. You can freeze your credit files, for example, and prevent new lines of credit from being opened. But you can't say, take me out of your databases entirely. And there's defensible reasons for that. The entire credit system is kind of built on this idea of having these kinds of information on people and having credit monitoring files. But it's still really frustrating for people to realize that, hey, this company has this huge amount of information on me and I can't tell them to delete it.
We are products, I'm sure, in other areas, in other facets, other industries. Do you see other weaknesses out there where people's personal data could be very much compromised, and as we as a product don't have much say over that?
This kind of goes back to that issue about transparency. I think one of the great frustrations for people is that in this era, with the technology, with the social media companies, with any number of other companies, more and more data is being collected, and we don't always know where it's going. And there is certainly an increased push among lawmakers and regulators to force companies to be at least clear about what they're collecting and what they're doing with it. But that's a very imperfect effort that's still in its very early stages.
And you write a lot on consumer issues and privacy and data. Is there anything we can do to protect ourselves from breaches like Equifax?
With breaches, it's very tricky. I mean, the best advice out there is don't reuse passwords and use long, complicated passwords. Passphrases are currently in vogue, so use a sentence, not a word, things like that. But the brutal reality is that there isn't a ton you can do. This really does come down to companies taking their responsibilities seriously to not lose that sensitive information that they possess.
Stacey, as you look forward here and as Equifax goes forward, as Facebook changes its policies, what are you watching for from these companies and so many others as how they go forward and, treat privacy and personal data?
I think that question of transparency is going to be really critical because there's a huge distinction, as we all know, between companies being quote unquote transparent and telling you in teeny little fine print what they're collecting and what they're doing with your data, versus companies making that really clear, really upfront, in really big letters, really early in their user process to let you know what's being done. And I think you see a handful of companies that really live up to that and really do make the effort to tell people what they're doing. Most don't. And it will be interesting to see if these kinds of penalties and action from regulators forces any real change in companies' stance on this.
And perhaps that transparency can impact their bottom line, maybe in a positive way.
Until they see that consumers really, really care about this and are willing to, you know, take their business elsewhere, if they don't feel companies live up to that, it's going to be really hard to get companies to change how they handle that.
Stacy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stacy Cowley is a finance reporter for the New York Times. She focuses on consumer issues and data security. Coming up, sometimes computer-generated images provides amazing visuals. Other times, it creeps people out. We delve into why new CGI movies are sending some viewers straight to the quote-unquote uncanny valley. We'll learn what that means. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. On a Thursday, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Stay with us next hour as we get your reaction to the testimony from former special counsel Robert Mueller. We'll have analysis and insights for you after 7. But first, let's talk about computer-generated imagery, CGI, in Hollywood. It's getting bolder and perhaps more experimental with how we blur the lines between a human, that real-life actor, and something digitized. Get a curious blend that may not sit so well with moviegoers. An example being the Jellicle Cats, the iconic Broadway musical Cats, is being made into a film. The trailer dropped last week, and social media got all worked up over incredibly realistic digital fur, CGI, that, take my word, does not translate to radio. You must see it for yourself. But here's a bit of the featurette with director Tom Hooper and actor James Corden.
We've used digital fur technology to create the most perfect covering of fur.
These are people, but they're cats, and this is kind of blowing my mind.
Kind of blowing my mind. How do you feel about CGI in movies today? What films are pushing the envelope for you in a good way? Which ones miss the mark? We're at 800-642-1234. Anne Hornaday is chief film critic for The Washington Post. Anne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
So CGI has been long part of the film industry, and the quality of the technology has never been better. Yet over the years, there are examples of it just kind of going awry. What is the rub there? When does CGI not sit well?
Well, the term of art that people use for it is the uncanny valley. And I think the movie that I first remember when the uncanny valley was a big, big thing was The Polar Express. Mm. If you remember that movie with Tom Hanks, mm-hmm. which was just this, it was just this eerie combination of animation, like motion capture animation that was based on human performance, but animated, just leaving behind the artifacts of the humanness, I don't know, in a way that was unsettling rather than immersive, you know? I mean, I think when people react poorly to things like the Cats trailer, it's because what should be kind of an immersive aesthetic experience becomes a jarring one and an unpleasant one. And I do think that, you know, a lot of these movies, and for me, another prime offender was the movie Speed Racer. It was, again, this kind of combination. I respected the experiments of them because these filmmakers, I guess this was sort of relatively the early days of this kind of filmmaking, and they were seeing how far they could kind of push the aesthetics. They wanted to create living cartoons, and I think that they might have succeeded in terms of a technological feat, but the psychological and emotional reaction from the audience is just like very, very off-putting.
Well, as a movie critic, how do you separate out creepy CGI from the overall aesthetic, the overall experience and quality of a movie?
You do. I mean, I think that what I try to do is appreciate if something is a technical achievement and I understand what they're going for, I do try to express that and support it. But then at the same time, I can't deny it if it's rubbing me the wrong way, you know, and I just think that it's part of the territory in this time when there's advances are so rapid that people are kind of, they're experimenting in real time, and we're seeing these. I mean, if this is a little bit off the topic, but if you even look at the progress that's been made between the first Toy Story, which was the first computer animated movie, the difference between that first one 25 years ago and then this latest one, you can see how far that technology has gone just with those movies alone. And Pixar has used pretty much every single movie it's ever made to push technology and to make it better. So I guess, you know, but to your point about being a critic, I just think that movies operate on several levels at once. And a good critic, I hope, would appreciate those levels as discrete things and then kind of take the overall measure of the movie.
We're talking with Anne Hornaday. She is chief film critic for The Washington Post, looking at CGI, animation, and how technology impacts the movies we see. How do you feel about computer-generated imagery or CGI in movies today? Do you dislike when visuals are a bit too lifelike? What happens in your brain? What does it make you feel? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. And earlier this year, a trailer for the new Sonic the Hedgehog, got the internet all worked up. Fans revolted against the trailer, calling it freaky, asking, why doesn't animated hedgehog have human teeth? Apparently, the feedback was so bad that the producers announced they'd be completely redesigning Sonic. what's the takeaway there?
Well, it's the fan. I mean, that's about fan culture and kind of fan service. And this intense feedback loop between the fans and the makers, and aesthetic expectations changing, and also and then the industry itself being in a position to be more responsive. I mean, that's actually a fascinating little case study there. And I mean, you can even look at the rise of Comic-Con, you know, that huge convention of comic book fans. They just wield so much power now, you know, in terms of what gets made and what we're seeing. I mean, it's almost like we have a Comic-Con culture now.
Wow.
It's really quite fascinating. But again, I guess it does come down to this kind of, you know, sometimes I'm not even sure, like they could point to specific things they didn't like about the design of that character, but you know, sometimes it's just something you can't even put your finger on, but it's just bugging you, you know? And I think there has been a little bit of divisiveness around the new Lion King around some of those issues too. That's kind of surprised me, but you know, this new Lion King has been made to look hyper, hyper, hyper photo realistic. In other words, it looks, for all intents and purposes, it looks like a nature documentary. And the director Jon Favreau put one authentically live action shot into the movie just to test to see if anybody could pick it out. But other than that brief shot, everything has been computer generated, and it is so perfectly rendered that I just forgot. I didn't even think about it, you know, after those initial scenes, because I so deeply bought the conceit, and it was so beautiful. But some have accused that of going into that CGI. Another term of art is dead eyes. You know, like the characters have these dead, weird eyes.
Right.
I didn't think so at all. I think these characters have animal eyes, and you know, they're not human. You know, they're not humanly expressive eyes, but they are authentic animal eyes. And we do the emotional work of kind of, you know, we and the voice actors are filling in those emotional blanks. So, I mean, I think it's often a question of personal taste and personal threshold too.
It's, and then wondering how you define it. It's not quite like Lion King, not quite live action, not quite animated. Like, how do you start categorizing things anymore?
When I was watching that one, that was my question. It's like, what is this? Because you're right. It's not animation. It's animated. And I wonder even, I mean, I would imagine that this will compete in the animated category at the Oscars. But I did have a fleeting thought of, gee, will it? I mean, would it? Is this, it's so unlike any animated film that we've seen up until now. Because it is animated and that it's all synthetically done, it's based on real world imagery that they captured, but it is an animated film, you know, with those voice actors. So I think it does qualify. But it's a really interesting, and again, that was a movie that was kind of, we saw the beginnings of that with Favreau's adaptation of The Jungle Book, which did have live action in it, but also had a great deal of computer generated imagery for the animals. And that was stunning. But this is taking it into whole new levels. I mean, you played that little trailer, the featurette about cats, and they talked about fur technology.
Yes, yes.
The fur and the wind patterns and water, I mean, they've all been historically very difficult to capture with animation. And all of those things are just at the peak of their technological capacities.
So would cats and this fur thing be an example of that uncanny valley?
Yeah, you know what? And I, to my shame, I still haven't. I brought myself to watch that Cats trailer.
But oh my goodness!
I know, isn't that awful? I try to stay away from them because I try to kind of go into things with fresh, you know. But I have. I've seen enough. Let me just put it this way: I've seen enough, and I do. I understand that it is weird. I mean, that is some weird stuff right there. It's. I mean. Like I said, you know, impressive, you know, in terms of that, I see what they're trying to do and it's impressive, but I can't necessarily say that I like what I see.
Well, going back to Disney, do you think Disney gets a pass in a way because we're more accepting of what it is doing with its remakes in terms of technology?
Well, that's a really good question. It'll be interesting to me. I mean, Disney, to your point, they've always done that. I mean, they've always been on the cutting edge of animation. And then they've also always been very, very careful stewards of their intellectual property. And that's always been their business model. It's just that now I feel, you know, part of their strategy I don't know how old you are. I'm old enough to remember they would hold things back. They would take things out of circulation for years and years and years. And then, right? And that was how they did it, because that was how you did it in the old school. And I think it's disorienting for me and my generation to see them be so aggressive with putting things, not holding things back, but putting things out in such rapid succession. So it's like, we get the remake, we get the prequel, we get the, you know, sequel, we get the da-da-da-da, we get the live-action version. And they're just, it's so rapid-fire. It is often concomitant with these technological leaps. And so, yeah, it is a little bit disorienting. And I do wonder if the audience is going to tire of it. Yeah.
Pause right there with Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday as our guide here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about CGI, cat humans, and other ways Hollywood is using technology to blur the lines between humans and something else. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Universal Pictures released its first trailer for the much-anticipated Cats musical adaptation, and then came the CGI fur uproar. We see cats walking around on their hind legs with human limbs and faces. It could be an acquired taste for moviegoers, but it's a good time to talk about CGI in our film experience with your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Will you see cats for the CGI? What movies are pushing the envelope in a good way, and which ones miss the mark for you? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday is our guide, and she stays with us. So, Anne, when you look at Hollywood and the highest grossing films of the year, you know, you've got like Avengers in there, you know, pushing close to almost $1 billion. These are all films that have technology and CGI really as part of their backbone. What does that say about the direction where Hollywood is going?
Well, you know, I'm not sure, and I would love if your listeners tell me if it. I wonder, and again, this might be more generational than anything else. You know, we now have a generation that's just grown up with CGI as a part. That is movie. That's what movies look like for them. And I don't think they even distinguish anymore. And I don't even know if people really care about, like, if they're going to go see this new Lion King, I suppose a lot of people will go out of curiosity to see the technology, you know, they'll have the technology in mind. But even if they're going with that in mind, what the movie makers want, I'm sure, is for them to forget about it and just become very lost in the story and care about the characters and just get totally into it. For Hollywood's part, it's just a tool in the toolbox. And if they're, it's kind of a piece with this business model we're in the midst of, which is very blockbuster oriented. It's very oriented to studios mining their archives for the intellectual properties they already own so that they can remake them cheap. And that's all about saving some money.
Economy,
and also minimizing risk. I mean, they want things that are sure bets. And whether that means serving the pre-existing fans of that property here in the United States, or more increasingly now, getting Chinese filmmakers interested. I mean, a lot of these movies, even if they don't do well here, they're going to do really well overseas now. And so it used to be that they were making movies for 14-year-old boys, and that's why they made comic book movies. Now they're making comic book movies because they're easy to export, and they don't need a lot of complicated translating, and special effects are a universal language.
The international box office is a huge influence.
Definitely. I mean, that is something that has changed over the last, you know, as these countries are building out more and more theaters, they're eager for content and product. This is it. And this is the kind of content and product that is, like I said, easily translatable and easily exportable. But I do think Hollywood, the industry, would make a mistake if they think that's the only thing that sells. Because, for example, the movie Green Book, which is a very human story, which I don't think had any CGI in it, certainly didn't have any explosions or fireballs, that did extraordinarily well in China. And it did very well in other overseas markets. And Spike Lee's Black Klansman did very well overseas last year. So I hope that the industry doesn't just say, well, if we throw enough bells and whistles at them and big explosions and things that go boom and things that are loud and shiny and CGI, that that'll be enough. No, I mean, I think it always comes down to the fundamentals of good scripts and good stories, great characters and fine actors. And, you know, those are the ultimate special effects, those fundamentals. And so, but I do think it's all wrapped up together. The CGI goes with the special effects, goes with the comic books, goes with this kind of overarching tentpole business model that they seem very attached to right now.
Talking with Anne Hornaday, she is chief film critic for The Washington Post. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, with your experiences watching CGI movies and where you see them headed. Let's go to Brian now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Hi, Brian.
Hi. My thought on this was the fact that the movie companies have really been trying to push the envelope. When you look back at movies like Forrest Gump, when they had Tom Hanks' character be in front of old presidents who have now passed away, and how they have these interactions. You know, that movie came on and was a huge controversy about trying to get the movie banned.
Brian, thanks so much for bringing that. So we've seen these moments before, Anne.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, that, like Polar Express, those were both Robert Zemeckis films. People like Robert Zemeckis, James Cameron, I mean, the industry, you know, there are these filmmakers that have historically been on that cutting edge and been willing to experiment. And to Brian's point, he's right. Like, and that, again, that was 25 years ago, and it was just shocking. And of course, you know, Woody Allen did it in a more low-tech way with Zelig. And now we don't even think anything of it. And a big example, or kind of adjacent example, that's coming out this year is the new Martin Scorsese movie with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. And they're going to be de-aged in that movie, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
And so the whole notion of de-aging, you know, seeing the younger, I'm trying to remember now, we've seen a couple recently of movies with younger versions of older actors that were fab, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy has done it. And that's another technology that I think we've seen them perfect in real time over the years, to the point where now it's pretty seamless. I mean, I don't remember the last time I thought it was cheesy and gross, you know? I mean, it's looking pretty good.
So do these films spark your imagination still, or do they leave less room for you to imagine anymore? Because everything is there for you. Everything is served up on that platter in the visuals.
I think that's a great question. And I think that's, you know, it's really funny because when I saw this version of The Lion King, it reminded me of a little TV show I watched as a kid called Tales of the Riverbank, which was a very gentle, sweet little show, and it black and white, you know, and it filmed real live animals, and then it had human actors do voiceovers for them. And it was, talk about low tech. Mm. I mean, my goodness, it was analog at its most analog. But it had a lot of imagination. You know, it left that room for imagination. And that's kind of what this one did for me, you know? I mean, it even though it's so kind of overworked and overproduced, it harkened back to that simpler thing. I mean, it's almost doing that same simple thing, just in a much more complicated, complex, technologically sophisticated way.
Anne Hornaday, are we at a moment here? Would you compare what is going on right now with CGI to any moment in film history evolution?
Oh, that's a great question, Kate. Well, you know, I think sound, I mean, we've always been paid more attention to visuals than sound, but you know, there was a great revolution in movie sound in the 70s and 80s as well, with people like George Lucas and Walter Murch, again, pushing that envelope, coming up with Dolby, coming up with multi-channel sound and sound effects. That was less obvious because I think people just physically, physiologically don't, you know, we don't have the same reaction to sound as we do to image. But it's the rapidity of it. And there's an internet term for this where progress is just so exponentially, you know, quicker now. The windows between eras are shorter, you know, in terms of before and after. And so I just think that's what's so stunning.
Well, Anne, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a fun conversation.
Anne Hornaday is chief film critic for The Washington Post. Be sure to stay with us next hour. We have analysis on former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony yesterday to Congress with time for your reaction. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.